You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Are there limits to free speech? And if so, where should they be set? In this week's podcast, Dr. Steve Davies, Head of Education at the IA, and news editor Kate Andrews examine this question. They take a look at free speech on social media and at universities, where issues like safe spaces and no platforming are increasingly controversial. But the situation is rather more complex than it might seem. Though speech should be as free as possible, private institutions and private individuals also have a right to determine what speech they permit on their own property. And public funding of institutions can complicate matters, as Steve and Kate explain. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Steve, everyone has their own definition of free speech these days. What's yours?
Free speech is the principle that you should be able to freely express what it is that you think, the opinions and views that you have about certain things or certain people, or indeed anything, in fact, subject only to the constraint that your actions, your speech actions, that is, should not entail incitement, which means actually and actively encouraging people to commit criminal acts such as violent assault or theft or some other kind of criminal or delinquent behaviour. So that's the kind of broad general definition of what it means. It means that basically...
I like your definition very much.
you should be free, if you wish, because of course you may not wish to exercise this right, to say whatever you like, subject only to that constraint about incitement, which is not a novel one. I mean, there's been a law against incitement since, the Middle Ages. Having said that, how that speech rights, that right to free speech, is actually exercised in a complex society is complicated. But that should still be the default basic principle, I think.
Mm. I think that's a fantastic definition, but I feel that so many have lost their way. I mean, certainly those who would like to curtail free speech are arguing that very much against your definition. But also sometimes I worry that free attempts for private people or private businesses to, say, not supply a newspaper or to ask their employees to not engage in a certain kind of language while at work is being seen as an attack on free speech. And I think there's a problem there as well.
Absolutely. There are a couple of points to make here. The first is that one of the ways in which the actual exercise of the free speech right I outlined is more complicated in a society is that it's also qualified by property rights. If somebody comes into my home, for example, my house, certainly they have a right to say whatever they like, but I also have a right to say, look, if you say that here, I am going to show you the door and throw you out. Similarly, private corporations, and I would count universities in that category, have a perfect right to say that on their campus, which is their property after all, and the area they control, certain kinds of speech will not be tolerated. I think that's perfectly reasonable. The question is whether or not there should be, a general ban, but it's very much qualified initially by the right of property. You do not have a right to say whatever you like on some other personal institution's property. That's one obviously major concern. The other thing, which is you sort of hint at, I think, in your question, is that many people seem to think that the right of free speech, the fact that you have a right to say what you think, has a kind of unspoken extra clause, which is without any consequence. Well, no, absolutely not. Rights come with responsibilities and also acceptance of the consequences or costs of the exercise of those rights. So if you exercise a right of free speech, you have to accept that this may come with costs for you. So, for example, it may be that if you hold a view which is very unpopular, not widely shared, regarded with repugnance by many of the people around you, that if you exercise your right and express your opinion, a lot of people will basically think you're an ass and may even socially shun you. And, well, that's perfectly reasonable, it seems to me.
It's within their right to do so.
Absolutely, it's within their rights to do so. And also, you should not think that this is something that comes cost-free. Surely it's important that you have a right to say what you want. It's important for public discourse that people do say what they want, but they must realise that this comes with a price. And, it may well be that it does lead you to lose your job or find you face social sanctions and penalties of one kind or another. The question you then have to decide as a responsible actor is whether or not you feel so passionately about the subject that you're speaking about that you're prepared to take those costs. But you shouldn't expect that you should simply be able to do so costlessly.
So I think that this becomes particularly challenging when we look at those muddled situations like university campuses, or I would even say public platforms like the media, BBC or Sky News. So on university campuses, obviously, those universities are receiving some level of public money. And also, now that we have students paying particularly higher fees, if you are going to start banning speakers from campus or telling students that speakers who adhere to their political affiliation won't be welcome, surely that should be in the contract before they sign up. So, you know, would you still recognize that even though bodies like universities have the right to deny speakers, there can become a problem when speakers, particularly from certain political backgrounds, aren't allowed to do so?
Actually, I don't think so per se. I think universities have a perfect right to ban people from a particular political persuasion or promoting a particular set of views if they feel that those views are incompatible with the particular mission or standpoint that they have. So, for example, I would not expect a Catholic university to be forced or compelled by law to provide free speech facilities to an atheist or to somebody who attacked the very basic principles of the faith that the university is founded on. The problem, I think, there is not that any individual university should or should not have a right to restrict certain forms of speech or expression. It's the lack of variety between universities. The problem, in other words, tends to arise not so much because any individual university has a right to decide who speaks or what is spoken on their campuses, it's the fact that there is so little difference between different universities as to what they think the right ideas are. If we lived in a world where there was much greater pluralism in higher education, where you have some universities which are strongly, let's say in American language, conservative, other universities that are strongly liberal or progressive, yet other universities which are religious in one way or another, then the fact that in each university there might be restrictions on what could be said would not be a problem because you could go to a different university. The problem is rather the homogeneity of the whole higher education sector.
Now, that's extremely interesting. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. But isn't there still a problem that if you have, again, in American language, a conservative group on campus and a more left-wing group on campus, that to allow one to bring their speakers but to ban the other from doing so still causes a problem for the free speech debate?
Well, the question here is what you think the functional purpose of the university is. Now, this is where the question you pose becomes very pressing. I've just said that I think universities should have a right to decide what kind of speech is made on their campus. The question about whether or not they should is another matter. Now, if you think that the purpose of higher education, the university, is to essentially teach a particular vision of the world, a truth, if you will, then actually it's quite important for the pursuit of that mission that you don't allow anybody and everybody to talk on campus. So, for example, going back to the example I gave, if you are a Catholic university, at least as these institutions were originally founded, the idea was to provide teaching which was in accordance with, or at least not contradictory to, the teachings and doctrines of the church. Now, that by definition means that you cannot have a complete free-for-all on the campus. Now, on the other hand, if you think that the purpose of higher education is to actually encourage competition and clash of ideas, to undermine certainty, to promote perhaps scepticism about claims to having the final truth, which is actually what I think myself university should be about, then clearly that is not compatible with the initial position. Now, the problem in the American Academy in particular, it seems to me, is rather that we've moved towards the first position, but with the presumption that the truth that is being discussed is that of a particular part of American society, and it happens to be the position of the majority of tenured professors and academics, whereas there's still a claim that what the university is engaged in is the open exploration of ideas. Now, if you think that that is the function of the university, then clearly there has to be an extremely wide latitude given to speech, and the kind of restrictions that you're talking about are incompatible. But it ultimately comes down to what you think the purpose and function of an institution of higher learning is. And that depends upon its original foundational purpose. And as I say, there's room for both, actually, in the system as a whole. It's just a question of the degree of pluralism. The problem in the modern academy is rather that there is not enough pluralism of perspective amongst the staff, the faculty, and other key groups, such as increasingly both students and donors, for example.
What do you think about giving platforms to essentially radical, extremely minority views on platforms like the BBC or Sky News? Because I've heard arguments that essentially if you're going to support free speech, then you have to give everybody a platform. Something about that grates with me. I'm not sure it is other people's responsibility to give a person a platform, especially if they represent something very niche. But again, in terms of the BBC, it is publicly funded.
Yes.
Is there an argument that every view should get some kind of platform?
Yes, this is the problem with public funding. Public funding muddies the waters significantly, both in higher education and in broadcasting and the medium more generally. Because to the extent that something is publicly funded, then I think you have a reasonable position to argue that any view which is held by some members of the public should have access to that public medium. Now, the way this used to be was with the post in the days when the mail was the main form of communication, when you actually communicated mainly with people by writing physical letters. The generally accepted principle was that because it was provided as a public service, a common carrier, to use the legal term, any views that were shared by any members of the public could be transmitted through the mail. The only restriction typically was on obscene publications. That was the only major get-out, or subversive, treasonous publications. But the general rule there is that because it's publicly funded, it's a public service, any views can find expression. Now, the problem with something like the BBC, then, is that this means that, in theory, you have to allow time for views which are held only by minority, very small minorities, or which are regarded as generally bonkers or seriously unpleasant by the great majority of the population.
And scary,
highly offensive,
yeah.
Yes. So, you know, the classic example is the alleged New York Times headline, "Shape of the Earth, Opinions Differ." Or the idea that, yes, well, you know, you can't have somebody talking about just assuming that the world is round. You've got to provide time for the Flat Earth Society, mm-hmm. and this kind of thing. And that, I think, shows you actually the problems with public funding. Because if you have a world of private funding media, it then becomes, as in the case of the universities, down to the people who own that particular private media channel or outlet as to what opinions they will agree to disseminate and broadcast. And again, as I say, that is not then a problem so long as you have pluralism of ownership and access. The more difficult issue, it seems to me, which was a big issue for technological reasons in the middle decades of the 20th century, but is much less so now, is that of how easy it is to get access to the means of disseminating views. And I think the argument, which was a very serious one in the middle decades of the 20th century, was that the cost of making, for example, television programmes or radio programmes was so high that this effectively meant that minority views held only by small dissident groups, faced an insuperable practical barrier in terms of getting access to the means of wider communication, quite regardless of any, you know, activity by governments or censors. But I think that actually is a case where technology has done away with the problem, because now, in fact, the cost of doing this is dropping like a stone all the time.
Make your own media, like
indeed,
we're doing right now.
As we're doing right now. And so actually it has become much, much easier to get round that problem now.
What direction do you think we're moving in when it comes to free speech legally, but also culturally? Do you think we're going to put up more barriers legally to free speech? Do you think we're going to start, for example, including hate speech, things that are ugly, but as you point out, not inciting violence? Do we think we're going to move towards outlawing things like that? But also culturally, I mean, it strikes me that our tolerance is certainly not increasing when it comes to people who have different perspectives from us.
No.
And so I completely agree with you, Steve, that if you are willing to say something, you risk the consequences of that, and you might become an outcast, and that might be exactly what should happen. But I do worry sometimes that people who are saying wholly reasonable things, who might be wrong or who might need to be critiqued, but, you know, really aren't going off the ledge and are saying pretty normal things, are being ostracized as well. And that does concern me.
Yes, I think there's two separate issues to look at there. The first is whether or not I think there will be legal action taken to restrict freedom of speech. Now, it's worth saying that definition I gave at the start, there are a number of people, of course, who reject that on principle, who think that, in fact, this is not the case. This is a position going back a long way, not least in some of the institutions I've alluded to earlier, like the Catholic Church, for example, where the idea is that, well, no, there is something called the truth, and that the idea historically, not now, of course, but historically was that one of the functions of the Church was, through things like the Index and other institutions, to ensure that, you know, ideas which were not conducive to believing in the truth did not find expression, and this was held to be a good thing. Now, obviously, that's not my position. Unfortunately, I think that's not the view now. The question is, are we going to move towards a situation where the state, the public agency, if you will, feels that it has a right or a duty even to ban certain forms of speech in order to ensure that the truth or maybe some other public good like civil order or social harmony is not disrupted? I think that there may be an effort in this area, but I'm much less alarmed by this prospect than many people are. I actually think that the problem is that although there are lots of people who dislike particular forms of speech expression, there are very few people who have a consistent view that there should be control of speech in general. And most people are smart enough to know that they could be the next person to fall foul of it. So even though people may object strongly to certain particular speech acts, I think that there's not enough of a constituency of support for general control of speech for this kind of legislation to be happening. I'm not saying it won't happen. I think it may happen in some places and times. But typically, actually, only in parts of the world where there is actually a broad consensus around a particular view, and therefore there's a sort of hostility towards dissenters of one kind or another. Plus, it's worth saying that even if laws like this are passed, I do think that, in fact, it's even more difficult to enforce them meaningfully now than it was, say, in the mid-20th century. It's now become, for the reasons I alluded to earlier, very, very difficult to enforce. The more serious problem is the one you allude to, and that is the fact that although more and more views are being expressed, and we probably have a wider and greater plurality of views and opinions being expressed now than ever before, people's tolerance for views that are not their own has actually diminished. And the result is that instead of having a conversation, however warm and heated, what we're having is essentially a shouting match in which, instead of engaging with people that you don't agree with, increasingly people in general seek to just shout the other person down or abuse them, shame them, drive them out of polite society. What I think this comes from is a very widespread and common sort of notion that is found, I think, in all parts of the political spectrum, although maybe more slightly in some than others. And that is the idea that there is a particular way of thinking about the world that is the only possible position for someone of good sense to have. Now, what that means is that, therefore, if somebody does not share that view, that means that either they are an idiot, and therefore not of good sense, or if they are clearly not an idiot, that they are therefore arguing in bad faith. They're only arguing the positions they have because of self-interest, or because they're being paid to do it, which is another form of the self-interest argument, or because they are trying to achieve some evil end by doing it. And in that case, it's no point in engaging with that person, because if they're arguing from bad faith, then they know that they're arguing something that they don't really believe in, because who could possibly sincerely and really believe what they're saying? And I'm afraid that position, that kind of perspective, is currently quite widespread. And I think the only solution to that really is simply not to respond in kind. You just have to be very, very polite and allow your interlocutors and opponents enough rope to hang themselves, basically.
Kill them with kindness.
It's a slow process. It will take a while. But I think eventually this kind of phase will pass. At least I hope so.
I hope so too, Steve. Thanks so much.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.